Good afternoon, your honors. James Hopkins representing Jacob Valdez, the defendant. Now, your honors, Mr. Valdez, through post-conviction counsel, ultimately submitted two 35C issues to the district court. The first one I'm going to talk about is that Mr. Valdez argued that appellate counsel was ineffective for failure to raise on appeal an issue of whether the trial court abused its discretion when it found Leroy Gallegos, a diagnosed schizophrenic person, competent to testify. Now, as an appellate attorney, I'll admit on my review of the record, this jumped out at me. There was a lot of discussion on the record about competency. So the issue of whether or not Mr. Gallegos was competent to testify is, to me, a glaring appellate issue. It was not raised by the appellate attorney. These are the things that we know about this competency issue and the appellate attorney's handling of the competency issue.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Hopkins. The standard, as I understand it, and please correct me, is that the issue has to be more meritorious than arguments that were raised to establish prejudice, or at least an allegation here, right?
Well, I've read the law on that, and as an appellate attorney, I hesitate often to decide whether one argument necessarily is more meritorious than another. I think the problem in this case is that without a 35C hearing where we know what the thought process was of the appellate attorney, we don't know whether it was a strategy decision or whether maybe there should have been two arguments submitted. I will concede, I believe the other question is, and that is that if there are clearly, arguments available in an ineffective assistance appellate scenario, I agree that it's generally understood that an argument needs to be at least as meritorious as other arguments for it to be submitted. I don't think it's clear from the record that that is not the case here.
But don't you, and here's kind of part of the, I suppose, where I was leading with my question, and I know you're in a very experienced and a fine appellate attorney. You make strategic choices. So recognizing that the district court here summarily denied the petition, it seems like you have to make some kind of allegation that this one had at least as good a shot as the arguments that were raised. And in fact, the appellate attorney went up to the Supreme Court, did a pretty darn good job here. And so that's what I'm concerned about, because as you know, when the appointed lawyer, as Mr. Burton, filed his supplement, it's a one-liner, and it barely even mentions these issues. You get them in the brief. And there really is never a discussion that I saw or an allegation that this was more meritorious or as meritorious. And that's, I suppose, and I'm really trying to focus on the standard now. Why wasn't the district court right without any even allegation that this argument had a better shot than what was raised?
Well, I guess, and as an attorney who handles both appellate and post-conviction issues, to me, seeing that Mr. Burton, as a post-conviction attorney, was choosing to raise this, and again, I'm kind of, this is kind of the pot calling the kettle black here, because one of my problems with denials of 35C hearings is that we have to make assumptions if there is not a 35C hearing in the district court. And, I can only assume that he was bringing this argument because he intended to present some evidence for the trial court to show why this argument was at least as meritorious, if not more, than the argument that was raised.
But doesn't he at least have to allege that? I recognize this one, we'll go out that the brief kind of took the place of an amended 35C, if you will. Doesn't at least, isn't that what 35C requires to get a hearing? At least an allegation. We have to assume is true what's alleged, but don't you need at least that?
I think that the allegation in this case is implicit by the fact that the post-conviction attorney, maybe they didn't specifically say the words, we believe this argument to be as meritorious as the one that was raised on appeal. I think the fact that they planned to present evidence at a 35C hearing on this issue, maybe it should have been more artfully worded. To me, that's an implicit argument that this is at least as meritorious as the argument that was raised on appeal.
All right, is it?
Well, I struggled with whether or not I should fully brief this issue of competency. And looking at the interplay between appeals and 35Cs, I felt that Mr. Valdez's purposes were better served by me not trying to have the appellate court specifically hear that, where that would most likely, depending on how the district court handled this, if a 35C hearing was granted, it would exhaust that argument. It was obvious to me that the post-conviction attorney, prior to myself being involved in the case, wanted to deal with that issue at 35C hearing. And I could only assume he had good reasons for that. So I wanted Mr. Valdez to have a chance to actually present evidence on this issue at a 35C hearing, and I was concerned that if I specifically argue that, yes, there was an abuse of discretion, then that wouldn't happen. He would be barred from arguing that at a 35C hearing if the case is remanded.
And this may be an unfair question, and you can duck it if you'd like, but I'm interested in the argument that you would make about why it's more meritorious. I think you yourself say that it may be unfair. You yourself said, I think, in the brief, the court has great discretion, or it's certainly in the brief. I don't think anyone would deny a district court has great discretion on a competency issue. The court, as I read this transcript, did not find Mr. Gallegos very credible. Said he knows what he's how to tell the truth. He suddenly has amnesia when he's talking about his stepbrother. I mean, you have those kind of statements by the court. In light of that, and the district court seems to me to pretty directly have said he's not credible. What argument would you make that that's a better argument than the Batson issue that won on appeal?
Well, Your Honor, I am going to kind of duck that question with all respect, because I do think that although I believe both these issues merit a 35C hearing, it's the second issue that Mr. Valdez raised regarding the possible testimony of an expert regarding eyewitness identification and psychological factors that could affect accuracy in that situation. If Your Honors don't have more questions on this, I'll submit to the court that I think the meritoriousness of the abuse of discretion and the competency issue was implicit. I have a sneaking suspicion I'm not going to win on this part of the argument today, but I do think that there needs to be some due time given to the second argument that Mr. Valdez also made. The second argument that Mr. Valdez made in his, or I have a number of arguments, the second argument that was retained and submitted to the district court for a 35C hearing was that trial counsel was ineffective for failure to retain and present testimony from an expert witness on the eyewitness identification by Ms. Smith, who was an 84-year-old elderly lady. And also that there were holdings, the Campbell cases specifically, that gave the trial attorney an opportunity to at least try to present this evidence to the court. And again, at the outset, I'm going to concede that this really is an issue that the trial court should have decided and wasn't really given the opportunity to. Now, in the trial court's 35C ruling, it says, well, this isn't going to go anywhere. Basically says there's no way this could have caused prejudice. But the trial court makes no findings on the Campbell cases. It's hard to tell, and I think we have to assume the trial court, well, I don't want to, again, using the assumption tool is always dangerous, but the trial court made no findings on the specific testimony that was alluded to, as I note in the briefs, an exhibit 2 that was supposedly attached or should have been attached to the 35C, which I was able to get a copy of from Mr. Burton, the post-conviction attorney. And it provided kind of an overview of proper testimony from this expert that could have been used at trial to help the jury see that there were a number of issues with Ms. Smith's identification.
Can I mean to interrupt you again, sure. Mr. Hopkins? Well, I guess I do, I'm doing it right. Could you address what, I understand there are these issues about, racial issues, et cetera, on identification. I guess I'd appreciate your addressing what the expert really would have added that would have added to what they already had. As I understood the trial court, the post-conviction court's order, it was essentially defense counsel took this witness apart. She had all kinds of trouble remembering. She was inconsistent in various ways. She couldn't remember her own jewelry or if it was her own jewelry. I mean, the trial counsel did a pretty darn good job of impeaching this woman. And as I understood the post-conviction court's order was, I don't see anything that an eyewitness identification expert was going to add to that. Tell me why it would have made any difference given a pretty devastating cross-examination here.
Well, and again, without the 35C hearing, Your Honor, there's a number of questions that just simply cannot be answered. One, we're not even sure if the trial court was really aware of the details of the testimony that could have been presented. For instance, there's evidence in the record that the witness was aroused, and that can be a factor in whether identifications are made correctly or not.
And this is in the report.
This is basically the offer of proof that we don't know whether the trial court saw it or not, but as an example of factors that could have been presented at a 35C hearing had there been one, the age of the witness, which I think was on everybody's mind probably at trial, cross-racial identification, time estimations, which there was testimony regarding how long the witness had to identify the defendant, and that had changed from time to time, from as little as a few minutes up to half an hour. Admonitions and the witness's expectations based on those admonitions and the way that the photographic lineups were presented to the witness, those could have had psychological impacts on the accuracy of the identification. And then the competence of the identification, which the Attorney General makes a note of, that in part some of the identification was very straightforward and confident, but that's another thing that the expert could have testified to in front of the jury about how confidence, as it's been tested for a number of years, is not really a good indicator of accuracy. A competent person can be absolutely wrong, they can be absolutely correct. There's only a slight increase in correctness with competent people. I mean, it's really, you know, it's about as likely that they're competent as the flip of a coin as they are accurate. You know, so the confidence, again, although often used by the prosecution in cases, say, look, this is a competent witness, doesn't necessarily mean they're correct. So there was a number of issues that expert testimony, which I, that's for the jury to decide when they hear that testimony, but experts can often deliver a lot of weight with their testimony, and it's testimony that was not even investigated or pursued by the trial counsel, wasn't even presented to the court, and without a 35C hearing, we don't know exactly what the testimony would have been. We can have some idea, you know, based on my offer of proof here today, but there's questions that would need to be answered at that 35C hearing to know whether or not there was ineffective assistance of counsel. One, did the trial attorney ignore this on purpose for a reason? Was it a strategy decision? We don't know anything about that. We don't know whether it was a lack of investigation or whether there was just, you know, a conscious decision not to use this type of evidence for some reason. And I would concede that I didn't think the trial attorney did a bad job with what they had in the trial impeaching the witness. But at the same time, that doesn't mean that they were effective. The trial attorney should use every bit of power they can muster to defend their client. And this was an open avenue for the trial attorney to use that they either didn't know about, or maybe they chose not to, but we don't know without a 35C hearing. This was a case, Your Honors, where guilt or innocence balanced largely on the testimony of this one witness. Maybe not completely, but very much so. And it was a case where if you look at the factors in the Campbell cases, and it's clear I disagree with the government on the Campbell cases, I think, and our interpretations of them, but the ID was key to the case. That's one of the issues that needs to be looked at. The ID was not independently corroborated or verified. That's a situation in our case. And expert testimony was available on specific psychological factors that were shown in the record and could affect the accuracy of the identification, but factors that the jury was probably not likely to know a lot about as average laymen. In essence, Your Honor, I think, Your Honors, I think that without a 35C hearing, we are forced to make guesses. We're forced to make assumptions. And a 35C hearing could give us the answer to some of those assumptions that we need. And I think under the facts of this case and the law, a 35C hearing is required. Thank you, Your Honors.
May it please the court. My name is Deborah Pratt, attorney number 13803. I'm an assistant attorney general and I'm appearing on behalf of the people of the state of Colorado. The defendant argues that the trial court erred by denying him an evidentiary hearing, but since the facts in the record are undisputed, the issues raised by the defendant are pure questions of law and can be decided without a hearing. Therefore, the trial court's decision to decide this case on the record and deny an evidentiary hearing was a correct ruling. The standard of review is important here, because in a case like this where the facts are undisputed, whether a motion states a claim for relief is subject to de novo review. This means this court can reach its own legal conclusions independent of the trial court's ruling. The defendant's first claim on direct appeal counsel, I think, maybe has been conceded. But I want to say that I do agree with the court that in order for the defendant to have properly alleged and brought up the issue of competency properly, he had to have alleged that appellate counsel was ineffective for raising other issues on direct appeal rather than the issue of, I'm sorry, Mr. Gallegos' competency. I agree with the court and with the Rodriguez case that I cited in my brief, the counsel's duty to render effective appellate advocacy requires prioritizing issues so that, and only raising a few, so that the good issues, the strong issues, won't be masked by weaker issues on appeal. In a typical case, Rodriguez says this is a strategic decision, and strategic decisions are rarely reviewable on claims of ineffective assistance of counsel. But to get an evidentiary hearing, you have to allege not only that counsel was ineffective for failing to raise this, but at a minimum, you have to allege that this decision was so far below the standard of care that the usual presumption would not apply. With regard to the failure to retain an expert in eyewitness identification at trial, I really want to object to the defendant's citation to a document that wasn't in the record, that wasn't in the briefs, that's outside the record because we don't even know if trial counsel attached it. I don't think that the trial court saw it because he didn't reference to it, but we don't even know that this was something that was properly argued and decided upon in the trial court below.
Well, what we do know, if I can interrupt here, Ms. Pratt, is basically there is at least a general, it's a reference to this report by the expert, and it says Exhibit A. I checked the record myself, and there was no Exhibit A attached. Says what it says, an expert testimony in the field of eyewitness identification, in particular eyewitness misidentification, was available, had they conducted a pretrial investigation, etc. Had counsel done so, he would have called Green to testify to challenge further the reliability and credibility of the victim's identification of the defendant, and then talks about Campbell. I suppose, we're looking at a summary denial here of the 35C. We have to assume the truth of that statement. So assuming the truth of that, why isn't that enough?
Well, because what the defendant talked about this morning, where there were certain factors that Dr. Green would have testified to that would lend themselves to the facts that were actually alleged in the 35C hearing. Let me be a little bit more clear. What was alleged was that this person was elderly, that her identification was inconsistent, that she got confused at trial, and she couldn't even identify her own jewelry, and therefore you needed an expert to come in and tell you certain things about this testimony that wouldn't otherwise be apparent to the jury in their common everyday experience of just knowing what people who grow older may or may not be able to do. And so the citation that this was specialized and that it would be, there would be specific factors that are things I've never heard of before, I think that's inappropriate. It's outside what you just cited to me as evidence of what Dr. Green would testify to.
So that expert report, the document, is not in the record anywhere?
It's not in the record at all. I looked for it. In fact, defense counsel conceded in his briefs on appeal that it wasn't in the record.
If it were, you'd say it's not appropriate expert testimony in this case anyway, because it was not of 702 assistance of the jury, right?
Correct. Correct. You need three things, and none of those were alleged in the 35C. It's one thing to say you should have asked for the expert, but it's another thing entirely for the trial court to say that was appropriate testimony. First of all, they would have had to show that that was reliable at that time. Campbell was in 1991. We don't have another Supreme Court case on eyewitness identification. I'm assuming part of it's because we had DNA evidence about that time, and we started talking more about DNA and less about eyewitness identification factors. But we don't know if in 1994, when this case was tried, whether or not that still was reliable evidence. Second, we don't have evidence on how this fit the facts in this case. Because the facts in this case, it looks to me like your normal everyday juror, this would be within their realm of common experience that they would be able to understand. And especially since this witness was totally impeached on cross-examination, you don't need an expert to come in. And an expert's supposed to testify on things that a jury doesn't already know about so that they can reach their own determination on credibility. And there's been no showing that that expert would actually do that in this case. Especially it wasn't alleged in the 35C hearing. And because the offer of proof on the issue of eyewitness identification at trial didn't demonstrate the need for such an expert, the trial court's denial of the defendant's claim is correct. So, if there are no further questions, the people would respectfully request that the defendant's convictions be affirmed.
All right, thank you, counsel, for your arguments. The case will stand submitted and a written opinion will issue in due course. That concludes